The first part of episode 2 in the vaccines, the truth about vaccines. April 2020.
Welcome back to the truth about vaccines, episode number 2. Are you familiar with the ingredients in the CDC's recommended vaccine schedule today? Did the polio vaccine eradicate polio? These questions and many more will be answered in tonight's episode. I hope you enjoy it. The truth about vaccines is to present this information in as clear, precise, accurate, yet unbiased method as is humanly possible, focusing on the science, creating awareness, evaluating studies to determine whether or not vaccines are safe and effective. We also will be addressing the fundamental topic of freedom of choice. So let's get rolling with tonight's episode. Many of the studies indicating that vaccines are safe are epidemiological studies. Here's Robert F. Kennedy Jr. explaining the concept of epidemiology.
Epidemiology is the study of populations and the impact, for example, of an environmental condition or toxin on an entire population. So what epidemiologists try to do is they look at the population that was exposed to the toxin and they examine the health outcomes, and then they look at an unexposed population, which are called the controls. But epidemiology is notoriously susceptible to manipulation. You could design an epidemiology study that proved that sex does not make you pregnant. How would you do that? You would eliminate all the pregnant people before you did the study. So that you just ended up studying people who were having a lot of sex, but nobody was getting pregnant. Ergo, sex doesn't make you pregnant. So, and that's what they did with these epidemiology studies that the CDC orchestrated. They eliminated the populations that had autism before they did the study.
I used to work for Merck. I sold Vioxx for them, 2001 to 2003, along with other drugs. And I really saw from the inside how shady and unethical things are done, and how data is kind of twisted around, the manipulation, the training that you really get, to how you can go in and influence doctors to say things that aren't even true, and convince them of it by building relationships and by making sure that you're their only source of information. So I worked for Merck and I saw how things went down on the inside, and I left because it was just, ethically, I couldn't stand it. But before I started working in pharma, I was just like everyone else. You know, I thought pharmaceutical drugs and vaccines were for the greater good. And then I saw it from the inside, how wrong that really is and how they twist all of the information.
There's a saying in my racket, which is environmental litigation, which is that statistics don't lie, but statisticians do. And statisticians, with an epidemiology study in their hands, have a perfect opportunity to manipulate data.
Statistics don't lie, but statisticians do. I asked Barbara Lowe Fisher, the head of the National Vaccine Information Center, to elaborate on clinical trials and vaccine testing.
These clinical trials are very small, relatively small. And they don't really, they're also cleansed in that the participants in vaccine trials often do not reflect the population that gets the vaccine after it's licensed. They whitewash it. How? Well, children who are sick at the time of vaccination don't get vaccinated. Lots of kids get vaccinated when they're sick in this country. Children who have severe allergies, who have brain and immune system disorders, they aren't in those trials. But a lot of kids like that get vaccines. All of them do. In these clinical trials, they'll often use a active placebo instead of an inactive placebo.
That was really one of the real surprising elements to me when I started to research, because conventionally, I mean, I worked in a lab, I know what a placebo should be. It should be an inert substance that has no physiological effect. When it comes to vaccines, it's very rare to find the studies that are actually used for the FDA approval to use a saline placebo. Instead, what will be used is either the background substance of a vaccine, which might have aluminum in it, or polysorbate 80, or some amino acids, or even more commonly, another vaccine that has already been proven safe. So for instance, if you want to test this year's flu shot, you will test it against last year's flu shot for its safety, rather than testing it against a saline placebo.
What safe really means is that it shouldn't harm you at all, that it shouldn't be any problem. But in safety studies, when it comes to vaccines, one thing for sure is they don't use a true placebo as the control. So when you're looking at a new drug, say for high blood pressure, you're given a high blood pressure medication and you're giving something like a sugar pill. Well, with vaccines, they bring a new vaccine to market. They use either another vaccine with a known safety profile, or they use a shot of a substance that they consider to be inert.
In the October 19th, 2010 edition of the Annals of Internal Medicine, there was a study published by researchers at the University of California. They reviewed 167 placebo-controlled trials published in peer-reviewed medical journals in 2008 and 2009. They found that 91.8% of the drug trials and 73.3% of injections, vaccines never described the ingredients used in their placebos. So if we don't know what's in a placebo, then how can we know if the study is valid? In other words, if you give a sugar placebo to a control group in a diabetes study, then it might skew the outcome, right? In this next section, we'll hear from several experts about the vaccine creation process and also some common vaccine ingredients. Talk about the way that vaccines are cultured, the substrates. I mean,
sure.
Just go into the details about that, because many people are unaware.
Yeah, well, they'll use chicken embryos, monkey kidney tissue, renal tissue from dogs, animals like this, aborted fetal tissue. They, of course, have to neutralize these things with toxic chemicals like formaldehyde, which is embalming fluid. Sometimes other forms of antibiotics are utilized in the production. Heavy metals to create an adjuvant kind of thing to aggravate the immune system so that they can use smaller amounts of the antigen that would produce what they're calling their holy grail, their antibody response. But it's an absolute nightmare because they haven't analyzed how it impacts other body systems in its entirety, much less multiple shots, multiple vaccines, all of the things that are in concert or the entire schedule.
In 2005, the FDA put out a report about the contaminants of foreign DNA in vaccines. And they said in their presentation, we do not know if any of the contaminants that we know exist in vaccines from foreign DNA will lead to the development of any event. And they left it as an event because they didn't know what event that would lead to, whether a takeover of the DNA in the body, cancer, cell death, inflammation. They had no idea. But in 2005, admitting that there are foreign DNA particles in vaccines that are unavoidably in there, they said, we don't know if any of these foreign DNA particles can lead to an event.
What's Tytron X100? Dow chemical. It's a Dow chemical surfactant in your household cleaner, in your industrial cleaner, in your paint. It's in your pesticides, Ty. It's a surfactant. And that's in your flu shot. And here's the thing. I don't care this whole concept of parts per billion. It doesn't make sense to me. If it's a toxic chemical, it's a toxic chemical. These chemicals, we know. Formaldehyde was in that flu shot ingredient list that my buddy shared with me. We know formaldehyde, according to the National Institute of Health, can cause cancer.
If you look at package inserts for pharmaceutical products, they're usually, you know, they're folded up nice and small on very thin paper, and they're usually about this big, tiny print, both sides, and hidden somewhere in that maze of tiny print that you can't quite read would be the actual ingredients in the product, whether it's a vaccine or a medication you're taking. And somewhere in there is this long list of potential side effects, right? And as a physician, if you were, every time you wrote a prescription, if you were to stop and go through all of that, well, you might as well close your doors. There is not enough time in the day to do that level of informed consent.
Let's take two people. One person person A, let's say, strong immune system, can respond to an infection, can respond to the presence of a virus and build their own antibodies, right? Person A. Now let's say there's person Z, immunosuppressed, living on junk food, vitamin D deficient, gets sick every winter, thinks they need a vaccine, all right? Now, person A, remember, strong response. Do they need a vaccine against the flu? The answer is no, because if they're exposed to the flu, they're gonna immunize themselves, right? So, because they have a strong response. Person Z, if they get the vaccine, does it work? The answer is no, because they can't have a response to it. The vaccine fails on the person who could theoretically benefit from it, and the vaccine is not needed on the person who doesn't need it because they have their own immune building system. So what do the vaccine companies do? They add chemicals to the vaccine, thinking about person Z. They say, this vaccine doesn't have a strong enough response. So we're gonna add these toxic inflammatory chemicals, these adjuvants, as they're called. Toxic, should never be injected, right, into anybody. They add those to cause an inflammatory response, to try to get that person's body to respond to that vaccine injection. And that is where a lot of the hazard comes from. That's where you get epilepsy, you get seizures, you get people put into comas, you get autism. It's because of the toxic chemicals.
Nobody questions whether vaccines contain toxic chemicals or not. The real debate is whether or not the toxic chemicals are contained in large enough quantities to actually injure the person.
But certainly there is injury. The Supreme Court has stated that there's injury. There's been a lot of money that's been awarded in lawsuits, $3.6 billion. And there are codes in the actual, as a medical doctor, we use diagnosis codes called International Classification of Disease, or it's actually International Statistical Classification of Disease. And we just transitioned from something called ICD-9 to ICD-10. But in ICD-9 codes, there's 18 different codes that specifically define vaccine injury. Nines, if someone wanted to Google them and look them up, they would type in ICD-9 and look at 978. And 979, and each of those ICD-9 codes have subclassifications 9 each, discussing the different injuries that are created by vaccines. So clearly, if there was no injury from vaccines, there would be no need to have an ICD-9 code. I mean, why would you create it? You know, why would you put that in your coding system if there were no vaccine injuries? The classification system defines it. It says here they are. Here's the 18 different injuries that we're going to list that you can give the patient as a diagnosis when they come in to see you.
Dr. Sawney mentioned ICD-9 codes, specifically 978 and 979, each of which have 9 vaccines that they cover, totaling 18 vaccines that have diagnostic codes. You can see them on the screen right now. Many vaccines contain formaldehyde and Triton X100, both of which are known to cause cancer. Now, formaldehyde can be broken down when we eat it, but it can remain in its whole form when injected. According to the American Cancer Society, the types of cancer common among children, such as leukemia, are the types most closely associated with formaldehyde. The CDC's position is that formaldehyde is contained in such small doses in vaccines that it doesn't threaten human health. However, there's a conspicuous lack of research into the effects of formaldehyde exposure through multiple vaccines in pediatric populations. Given that infants and small children possess a much greater sensitivity to toxins compared to adults, and that formaldehyde is introduced to children through vaccinations containing a host of other toxic ingredients, shouldn't the CDC do some research and reevaluate its use in vaccines? Monosodium glutamate, also known as MSG, has been used as a food additive for over a century, but now it's also an ingredient in some vaccines. Dr. Russell Blaylock notes that MSG is classified as an excitotoxin, or a compound which overstimulates cell receptors to such an extent that the cell ceases to function normally, resulting in damage to nerve cells and contributing to seizures.
Vaccines are grown in a substrate. Some people, a substrate would be a petri dish. It's basically a medium that the vaccine can be grown in. So there's viral vaccines, there's bacterial vaccines, and the vaccines can be grown in human as well as animal tissue, basically animal and human living tissue. Some examples are chicken fibroblasts and embryos, chicken retinal and kidney cells, monkey and dog kidney cells, human embryonic tissue, lung tissue specifically, the fibroblasts found in aborted human fetal tissue, as well as monkey brain tissue. And there's others, but these are some of the more common substrates that live vaccines are grown in living cells. But the problem is that now we're finding that these substrates also contain other harmful additives like glyphosate. So glyphosate, which is Roundup, which is a pesticide, herbicide pesticide made by Monsanto, is making its way into the vaccines as well. So, you know, we spray glyphosate ubiquitously, you know, almost on so many food products that they're actually finding their way into the vaccine. So when you're getting injected with a vaccine, you know, we're typically worried about things like thimerosal, mercury, phenols, you know, other chemicals, things, glycols, ethylene glycols, basically antifreeze, but also glyphosate. So in 2015, the World Health Organization actually declared glyphosate to be a probable carcinogen, okay? So it's probably a carcinogen, and it's being injected into your body when you get a vaccine. So in effect, you know, injecting a vaccine into someone's body that is contaminated with a probable carcinogen, glyphosate, probably deserves some congressional investigation in terms of its safety.
My son Bryce and I recently took a trip to Washington, D.C., and we sat in meetings with senators and members of the House of Representatives that are attempting to sponsor legislation to look into vaccine safety. Dr. Sawney mentioned glyphosate specifically. Here's MIT scientist Stephanie Seneff discussing this important issue.
The glyphosate is a sleeper because its toxicity is insidious and accumulative. And so it slowly erodes your health over time. But it works synergistically with the vaccines. This is what I'm finding, and this is what I believe. And particular because glyphosate opens up the barriers. It opens up the gut barrier and it opens up the brain barrier. The brain has usually a very secure barrier that keeps toxins out, but the glyphosate messes that up. And as a consequence, those things that are in the vaccines get into the brain, whereas they wouldn't if you didn't have all the glyphosate exposure from the food. So the children who have sort of the leaky gut and they have the sensitivities to foods, they have gluten intolerance, you know, those kids are the ones that are especially vulnerable to damage from the vaccines, because those are all indicators of glyphosate poisoning, and they're also indicators of leaky gut, and leaky gut is an indicator of leaky brain. So the poor child is getting these vaccines and this stuff is going into the brain and it's causing neurological damage.
Something is happening to the brains of our children that is exciting, igniting, inflaming, irritating, agitating, and interfering with the proper sequencing of how the nerve cells sequence, develop, and proceed towards normal brain development. Speech delay is not a given. Learning disability is not a given. Low tone, weak muscles, lack of coordination, not sitting still, not focusing, not paying attention, these are not things that are a given. They are only happening because something is irritating, inflaming, agitating the brain and interfering with the way in which the brain is supposed to properly, sequentially develop.
There's a consensus in the scientific community that something is happening to the brains of our children. A surfactant is a compound that reduces the surface tension and increases the solubility between two liquids that would normally be unable to dissolve together, like oil and water. In vaccines, polysorbate 80 acts as an emulsifier to disperse all the other ingredients evenly within the liquid. Let's listen to medical doctors Tony Bark and Larry Pilevsky.
We use polysorbate, which the other name is Tween 80, to open the blood-brain barrier when giving chemotherapy for brain cancer, right? We know it opens tight junctions, desmosomes, or the blood-brain barrier, or the gut barrier. They're all the same, but the scientific or medical name for these things are tight junctions or desmosomes.
So what we have is a lot of people who are espousing what other people tell them. But if I presented my medical research around vaccines to my colleagues in medicine, they would be ashamed of themselves, because they would never know that the aluminum in vaccines is not the same aluminum that you ingest or inhale. that the aluminin in vaccines is in such a structure that it can easily pass into the brain and bring with it viruses and bacteria. That the emulsifiers in vaccines, called polysorbate 80, are used by the pharmaceutical industry to get drugs to pass into the brain across the blood-brain barrier. But they're also in vaccines. And they also attach really strongly to aluminum. So as an adjuvant, aluminum has a kind of structure that binds tightly to the bacteria and the viruses. And then the polysorbate 80, the emulsifier, binds really tightly to the aluminum and to the bacteria and viruses, and can walk into the brain the way a ghost can go through a wall. The pharmaceutical industry uses particles like aluminum that are in vaccines to attach to drugs, to get them to go across the blood-brain barrier, because drugs don't go across the blood-brain barrier otherwise. And then the pharmaceutical industry uses an emulsifier like polysorbate 80 to attach to the nanoparticle, that aluminum type particle that is bound to the drug, to increase the entry of that drug into the brain 20-fold. That same technology that the pharmaceutical industry uses to enhance delivery of drugs across the blood-brain barrier into the brain is the same technology in vaccines. So, knowing that science, the question has to be asked, do vaccine materials enter the brain? No studies. Are vaccine materials supposed to get into the brain? No. If vaccine materials get into the brain, what happens? 1 in 6 children with neurodevelopmental disabilities, 1 in 50 with autism, 1 in 10 with ADHD, 1 in 20 below the age of 5 with seizures. Until proven otherwise. In 2011, there was a study published that surveyed over 91,000 children that showed that 54% of those children had at least 1 of 20 chronic illness. Now, here we are in 2016. I started medical school in 1983. These were not the data we were seeing.
Dr. Pilevsky stated that we need to do more testing of vaccines that contain substances like polysorbate 80 and assume that they are doing damage until proven otherwise. According to the Material Safety and Data Sheet, the MSDS, on ScienceLab.com, polysorbate 80 was tested for inhalation and ingestion and demonstrated to be slightly hazardous in the case of skin contact. The MSDS does not address the effects of polysorbate 80 through injection. Nevertheless, in the same toxicology section, under special remarks on chronic and toxic effects on humans, it states that polysorbate 80, and I quote, may cause adverse reproductive effects based on animal test data. No human data found. There appears to be a glaring lack of basic science research into the toxic effects of the vaccine ingredient, polysorbate 80, on human health. Some argue that ingredients like polysorbate 80 in vaccines are safe and not dangerous, simply because they're present in vaccines in minuscule amounts. However, the fact remains that the CDC's mandated vaccine schedule tells doctors to give infants and children 49 doses of vaccines by the age of 6. The CDC vaccine excipient media summary indicates that the DTaP, influenza, meningococcal, pneumococcal, rotavirus, and Tdap vaccines all contain polysorbate 80. What are the cumulative effects of multiple vaccine ingredients? According to the MSDS, polysorbate 80 may cause cancer based on animal test data and may be mutagenic. Should the vaccine manufacturers and the FDA be required to provide credible scientific evidence that it is safe to include polysorbate 80 in vaccines given to adults and children? Another ingredient in many vaccines, which has already been mentioned many times, is aluminum. According to the CDC, aluminum is present in Hep A, Hep B, DTaP, Tdap, Haemophilus influenza type B, the HIB, HPV, and pneumococcal vaccines. Aluminum is put into vaccines as an adjuvant or an additive that helps them work better.
Unless it's a live viral vaccine, It's used as an adjuvant, and an adjuvant is something to boost the immune response, right? So a live virus, like the chickenpox vaccine, like MMR, those are all live viruses. So they can, and the shingles vaccine. So one of the side effects of those vaccines is that they cause those diseases. And the shingles vaccine just had to add that, you know. By the way, the shingles vaccine, one of the side effects may be shingles. But if it's not a live viral vaccine, then they have to use something to boost it because otherwise there's like a weak immunological reaction.
And that's why the aluminum comes in.
And that's where the aluminum comes in, because your body doesn't like it. It's toxic to the nervous system. So you create antibodies to it and everything associated with it. And that is a big part of the problem. And then, you know, then there's more biochemistry involved. There's fluoride on board, which, you know, there's a lot of fluoride. If there's other things on board, it goes right into the central nervous system. I mean, it's a mess.
Dr. Christopher Exley, who's been studying aluminum for over 30 years, he's a specialist in the ecotoxicity of aluminum, has shown that aluminum can lead to food sensitivities. So we're now reacting to foods that we wouldn't normally be reacting to. There are mouse studies that show this. Dr. Shaw has a study that shows you inject a mouse with aluminum and now they can't tolerate that next bite of food that they eat. They develop IgG antibodies to it. We also know Dr. Schoenfeld has been studying autoimmune disease. He's in Tel Aviv. He's published over 1,600 papers. He's been cited over 20,000 times on PubMed. He's written books. He wrote the book, Vaccines and Autoimmunity, talking specifically about aluminum and how it cools the body, meaning there's increased food sensitivity, there's increased autoimmune disease. So we're talking multiple sclerosis, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's. All of these things are directly related to the aluminum that's being injected.
One thing that, you know, we don't always mention is the increasing incidence of neurodegenerative diseases in adults. And some of the studies about the aluminum nanoparticle that are being introduced show that when you inject an aluminum nanoparticle, which again is not the same aluminum that we inhale or we ingest. So pediatricians who say, oh, come on, the amount of aluminum that's in vaccines is so small compared to what we are exposed to in our life, are not paying attention to the fact that the aluminum is in a nanoparticle form. It is bound tightly to vaccine bacteria and viruses, and it's bound tightly to polysorbate 80 and bound tightly to anything else that can bind to a nanoparticle and to an emulsifier like polysorbate 80. These materials are not only getting into the brain, but the aluminum is being found to stay inside the cells for years.
When you eat aluminum or you eat other toxins, you're open from your mouth directly. The digestive system is an open system.
Yeah.
There should be an intact barrier,
right,
protecting whatever we eat to go directly into the bloodstream,
true,
right? So theoretically, you're not absorbing much aluminum when you eat it. You excrete it in your stool. It's still not good, and I don't recommend it.
Yeah.
But ingesting is very different than injecting, where you also have things like polysorbate 80, things that actually open your blood-brain barrier, so they open all these tight junctions and you're getting them directly into your bloodstream, especially when you're injecting.
There's a big difference between injecting aluminum and ingesting aluminum. How much aluminum is safe?
How much aluminum is safe? This is something I want us to talk about. There's an FDA document that's live today, it's been up since 2000, that says not to exceed 5 micrograms per kilogram per day, or you can cause neurological problems and bone deposition, and probably other problems. The New England Journal of Medicine article, and I think it was 1998 by Bishop, they found that for every day you were on more than 5 micrograms per kilogram per day of Hyperal, which had that aluminum in it, you lost 1 point on your Bayley's developmental score. So this is significant developmental damage from aluminum. Now the interesting thing that gets debated, and it drives me nuts, is that was a study of Hyperal, so aluminum that was in the food that goes in the vein, and they talk about parenteral aluminum. That's what the FDA put in their document. That's what Bishop was talking about. Parenteral means outside of the enteric system. So in other words, it's injected. It's either directly in the vein, which is what they were referring to there, but when you give a shot, that's parenteral. You are not giving it through the oral cavity. And the CDC has, you know, articles and statements about the safety of aluminum, and they're using enteral. doses.
Something you inject.
Yeah. Our GI tract is like our skin. It has an epithelial lining whose job is to protect us from toxins. And there's a whole system set up in the GI tract to help you not have toxicity from what you eat. Because, you know, when you eat food and dirt and whatever, there's toxins. Well, we have a mechanism for avoiding toxicity when you take it orally. There, you bypass those when you inject. And so this is why it is vital that we start looking at the aluminum content of vaccines the same way we did for mercury, dimerosal, because we are far exceeding the safe doses.
The aluminum that they put into these vaccines, kids at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months are getting overdosed with aluminum. And there's very high aluminum content that, and children that receive their pneumococcal vaccine, their hepatitis B, hepatitis A, okay, the DTaP vaccine. These vaccines have high aluminum content, and the studies are showing that the aluminum is causing neurological and immunological damage. They're causing autoimmune diseases, and the FDA has established a safety level. And children that receive the hepatitis B vaccine at birth receive 20 times the content of aluminum, 20 times above the FDA's safety level. Children at 2 months of age are receiving 50 times above the safety level as established by the FDA.
Dr. Thomas just mentioned the term parenteral, and he also mentioned an FDA document that indicates the safe daily aluminum limit. Neil Miller also referenced the same FDA safety level. I found the document. According to the FDA's Code of Federal Regulations, CFR Title 21, Volume 4, posted at FDA.gov, the FDA maximum allowance for parenteral aluminum received is 25 micrograms per day. As Dr. Thomas mentioned, parenteral means anything not given orally, so vaccines are considered to be parenteral. According to the FDA regulation, the maximum amount of aluminum per kilogram of weight to give to a person is up to 5 micrograms. And any product that has more than 25 micrograms of aluminum is supposed to have a warning label stating that, and I quote, aluminum may be toxic to the central nervous system and to the bones, which Dr. Thomas just mentioned. However, vaccines, for some reason, are not required to have this label and are not required to follow the maximum dosage of 25 micrograms. I got a degree in accounting at Baylor University, and my father was actually a math major at Baylor. So humor me for a second and let's go on a math journey together, okay? Let's do some math. Following the 5 micrograms per kilogram maximum allowable parenteral dose of aluminum, the following are examples of weight with their corresponding maximum levels of aluminum per the FDA. An 8-pound baby would be 18.16 micrograms of aluminum. A 15-pound baby would be 34.05 micrograms of aluminum. 30-pound toddler, 68.1 micrograms of aluminum. 50-pound child, 113 micrograms. 150-pound adult, 340.5 micrograms of aluminum. And a 350-pound adult, 794.5 micrograms of aluminum. So, exactly how much aluminum is in the vaccines that are routinely given to children? The HIB vaccine, 225 micrograms. Hepatitis B, 250 micrograms. The DTaP, depending upon the manufacturer, it ranges from 170 to 625 micrograms. The pneumococcal vaccine, 125 micrograms. Hepatitis A, 250 micrograms. HPV, 225 micrograms. And the penicillin DTaP, the HIB, and the polio combo vaccine, 330 micrograms. The pediatrics DTaP, Hep B, and polio combo vaccine, 850 micrograms. At birth, 99% of children in the United States are given the hepatitis B vaccination. If the baby's typical size, and let's say he or she weighs about 8 pounds, the amount of aluminum in the hepatitis B vaccine alone is almost 14 times the amount of aluminum that's FDA approved. In addition, at well child checkups, it's common for 2 month, 4 month, 6 month appointments to include up to 8 vaccinations that add up to more than 1,000 micrograms of aluminum. According to the FDA limits, that amount isn't even safe for a 350-pound adult.
The issue there is aluminum is a highly neurotoxic, and a child who can't get rid of
neurotoxic aluminum is going to have brain damage from aluminum exposure. We know that. We have the science to show it.
I think it's important to see what we're seeing, to actually look at the patient and change our mind when new information comes in. You know, we had an idea of what vaccines were over the last few decades. We have an idea. But in the last year, we found out that aluminum is neurotoxic. It's got these autoimmune issues. We found out that there's glyphosates in the vaccine. Dr. Anthony Samsel and Stephanie Seneff at MIT just discovered that. We're finding out all this new information. So I think any good scientist should take this new information and look at the picture again. We do that with anesthesia. We previously weren't testing our anesthetics on children under two because there's an FDA issue with trying to get children into studies, and that's understandable. But then when we saw that there was a correlation that children were getting injured under age two, they were looking at when children got anesthesia for ear tube placement, that they were having memory problems years later. So they were able to tease that out. There's a program called Smart Tots with anesthesia. They were able to tease that out with anesthesia. I think we should do the same thing with vaccines. Now that we're coming with new data, new information about what vaccines are or aren't doing, I think we should take a critical look scientifically and what is happening. I think it's an important question.
What people don't realize is informed consent is only as informed as your doctor is who's giving the informed consent. Right? So unfortunately, most of my peers don't even realize there's aluminum in these vaccines. Or if they do, they don't know how much is in there. If they do, they don't know what the safe dose is for aluminum. Because you see, we were trained that aluminum's safe. It's been in vaccines since the beginning of time, and it was studied and it was proven to be safe. At least that's what we were told. But if you go really look into it, there's hundreds of studies. I have two books, entire books, just on aluminum toxicity. There's ample information that should have us questioning what we're doing.
Possibly the most widely known and controversial ingredient in some vaccines is a preservative known as Tamiflu, which is approximately 50% ethyl mercury. According to the CDC, and I quote, flu vaccines in multi-dose vials contain Tamiflu to safeguard against contamination of the vial. It's commonly believed that Tamiflu mercury was removed from all childhood vaccines over a decade ago.
Mercury is still in vaccines. It's not just in the flu vaccine. It's still in trace amounts in the vaccines that previously had tremendous amounts of mercury in it. Thimerosal is still in the vaccines, ethyl mercury being the organic form of mercury that's in the thimerosal, is neurotoxic. But now there's more aluminum in the vaccines. And aluminum and mercury together potentiate its dangerous properties of creating death in nerve cells than if you had just aluminum and mercury alone.
Dr. Pilevsky just mentioned the term trace amounts, which, by the way, is the title of an amazing documentary produced by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. On the CDC's vaccine excipient summary, many vaccines such as the DTaP, Hep A, Hep B, and the single-dose flu vaccines like Fluvarine and Fluarix have Tamiflu listed as an ingredient, but it has an asterisk. At the bottom of the document, it states, where Tamiflu is marked with an asterisk, it indicates that the product should be considered equivalent to Tamiflu-free products. This vaccine may contain trace amounts. So in essence, Tamiflu-free products may actually contain Tamiflu. It's kind of like stevia, which is an extract from the sweet leaves of the stevia plant, and it's listed as having 0 calories, or so I thought. On the particular brand of stevia that I use, there's also a little asterisk at the bottom of the container, and it states, each 1 teaspoon serving contains less than 2 calories, which the FDA considers dietetically zero. So, you know, as you already know from this episode earlier, I'm a math guy, so indulge me again. Let's say that each packet contains 1.9 calories, which is about accurate from what I can ascertain. It's still considered to be calorie-free. Now, let's say that I want to replace sugar with stevia in a recipe, cup for cup. If the recipe calls for 3 cups of sugar, I'll replace it with 3 cups of stevia, which is 144 teaspoons. This would equate to 273.6 calories from an alleged calorie-free substance. So, back to trace amounts of Tamiflu. Exactly how much is a trace amount? As we read earlier, the CDC says it's less than or equal to 0.3 micrograms per dose. I'm not going to explain the math, but I'll put it on the screen right now. And after we convert micrograms per milliliter to milligrams per kilogram to parts per million to liters to parts per billion, et cetera, et cetera. You get the picture. We see that there can be up to 600 parts per billion of Tamiflu in the Tamiflu-free vaccine. Just to put this 600 parts per billion number in perspective, according to the EPA, 2 parts per billion is the limit in drinking water. And if a liquid has 200 parts per billion of mercury, then it's considered to be a toxic hazard. In other words, Tamiflu-free vaccines can contain 3 times the amount of mercury that the EPA allows in a liquid before it's declared to be toxic waste. And here's a 2005 study from Toxicological Sciences Journal that indicates Tamiflu at 1 part per billion is toxic to neurons. As I mentioned earlier, I traveled to Washington, D.C., and I attended a press conference where Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Robert De Niro offered $100,000 to anyone who can find a study indicating that Tamiflu is safe.
We just did a press conference, and we did this yesterday with De Niro. We have 240 studies on Tamiflu that says it's causing brain injury, it's causing ADD, ADHD, speech delay, language delay, it kills brains and rats, and chipmunks and squirrels and hamsters and gerbils and cows and goats and pheasants. And we have that study this high, 240 studies. Then we have 81 studies that show it could cause autism this high. And we have a little placard that says studies that says it's safe. Not one. And what De Niro and I said, we will pay $100,000 to anybody who can point to a single peer-reviewed study that shows it's safe. It doesn't exist.
There are at least 240 studies that have focused on Tamiflu and have found it to be harmful, with adverse events including allergic reaction, malformations, autoimmunity, developmental delay, and neurodevelopmental disorders, including tics, speech delay, language delay, and ADD. 81 of these studies indicate a link with autism. The material safety data sheet, the MSDS, for Tamiflu indicates that it is mutagenic. In other words, it affects genetic material. It damages kidneys, the liver, spleen, bone marrow, and the central nervous system, and may cause cancer based upon animal data. It also adversely affects fertility and causes birth defects. The toxicity of Tamiflu was the focus of a meeting in June of 2000 at the Simpson-Wood Conference Center in Atlanta, Georgia. The CDC commissioned a meeting with the World Health Organization, the FDA, the Institute of Medicine, and representatives of several vaccine manufacturers. According to the transcripts of the Simpson-Wood Conference, which are readily available online due to FOIA requests, the gist of the meeting was to convey the fact that the CDC's data showed a statistically significant relationship between neurodevelopmental disorders, especially autism, and Tamiflu that children received through the vaccines. One of the most telling quotes from that conference is from Dr. William Weil of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I quote, "The number of dose-related relationships between mercury and autism are linear and statistically significant. You can play with this all you want. They are linear. They are statistically significant."
You go all the way back to Simpsonwood when they had all the six pharmaceutical companies, I believe it was, that got together, and the Institute of Medicine was there, and the president of the Institute of Medicine had just had his grandson or granddaughter born, and they were talking to the epidemiologist, and basically they were talking about the incidence of autism with children that had been exposed to Tamiflu and vaccines, and the epidemiologist said that there is not only a correlation, but there is a high statistical correlation between autism and the use of Tamiflu, and the Institute of Medicine said, go back and reanalyze the data, and the epidemiologist said, it doesn't matter how you manipulate this data, it's so significant, no matter what you do, it's going to show up. And the president of the Institute of Medicine at that time made the comment, and this is part of the transcripts that have been discovered, part of the transcript said, he made that comment, he said, well, my grandson, or my granddaughter, I can't remember what it was, is not going to get this. And he was just born, the child was just born. He said, my grandchild is not going to get this. However, we cannot let the general public know this information. Why? Because they know it would cause mass chaos, right? I mean, if there was going to be a motivation for the next civil war, that would be it.
Yeah, you're messing with our kids.
That's right. That's exactly right.
They looked at mercury and thimerosal in vaccinations, and they looked at the association between thimerosal and how early infants are exposed to it. And what they found in the data which they said we can't make this go away, that was literally written in some of the FOIA documents, was that the earlier the exposure, the greater the risk for autism. So what happens? Well, at the same meeting, we see a recommendation to start pushing the flu shot on pregnant women. Now, the flu shot has mercury in it.
That's really, really, really early exposure for the infant.
Yeah. So I'm sitting next to a legal expert when I'm hearing this, because I'm hearing that I got this information at a conference, and it was Brian Hooker, Dr. Hooker, who was presenting his FOIA documents. This was before he talked about the CDC whistleblower. It was actually just before. Well, actually, he did talk about it, but we didn't know who it was. But he was explaining this data, and we saw the data from the documents. And I'm sitting next to Mary Holland. You know who she is? She's
yes.
She's fabulous, right? Mary looks at me. She goes, wait a minute. The earlier the exposure to thimerosal, the greater the risk for autism. So why would they turn around and recommend to give the flu shot with thimerosal in it to pregnant women?
And this is the ongoing crime when it comes.
Episode 2 at 46
and the last couple years they've really made
minutes
a push to add the Tdap
starting 46 minutes
and pertussis. That's another whole story, but the problem with that one is huge dose of aluminum injecting it, so you're kind of like mainlining a toxin to a developing brain. No testing. You can go to the CDC website and go to vaccines and pregnancy, and you can look at the articles that they list as justification for doing those, and I've looked at them. I've pulled every single article and read it word for word. There are no long-term studies. They're all very short-term, very small numbers, sometimes 100 or less pregnancies, and what they're calling safe has nothing to do with looking at neurotoxicity.
Every freshwater fish in America now has advisories on it, telling pregnant women not to eat it. The mercury in thimerosal is 50 times as toxic to brain tissue and twice as persistent in the brain as the mercury in fish. So why would we inject that into a pregnant woman or a little baby? It doesn't make any sense.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. just mentioned that thimerosal, ethyl mercury, is 50 times as toxic to brain tissue and twice as persistent as methyl mercury. These figures were taken from the 2012 Guzzi study and the 2005 Burbacher study. A recent 2017 CDC study published in the Reviews of Environmental Contamination and Toxicology also confirmed that ethyl mercury is more toxic than methyl mercury. Mercury toxicity is one of the CDC's top concerns.
When I met with the Centers for Disease Control, the second time I met with them in 2006, I was going through one of their manuals, and I was with, I won't say who the person was, but a very high level individual in the CDC, MD, PhD, great guy. Just to give you an idea, it was supposed to be a half hour meeting, ended up being a 6 hour meeting, and when I left, we actually hugged, because he was so appreciative that there were actually people out there. He had no idea there were people out there that were actually addressing some of these things. So there are people at the CDC and the government that are actually well-versed and know the truth and really want to do something. They have the right motivation. Not everybody's like that, but there are people out there. You know, just in case people think that, oh, that everybody's against us, well, there are good people out there. And during our conversation, I asked him, I said, what's your most significant, I'm flipping through this catalog, or it's a directory of all these different toxic materials. And so I expected him to tell me it was going to be one of the fluorinated hydrocarbons. That's the biggest concern for the CDC from a level of toxicity aspect. And he said, this is why I can't say his name, but he said, if you bring this up in public, I will deny it. And I, you know, he thought it was like a trick question. I'm looking at him thinking, well, what's the big deal? His number one concern, it's not persistent organic pollutants, it's metal related. Mercury is a number one concern.
Wow.
Number one. The second most toxic substance known to man, according to the Centers for Disease Control and the Environmental Protection Agency, is mercury. So how can the second most toxic substance known to man on this entire planet be good for you?
Are you enjoying episode 2 thus far? Are you learning a lot of great information? Do you want to join our movement and support our mission to educate the entire world on the truth about vaccines? Then please consider supporting our mission by owning the complete series today. Your support allows us to continue to spread the truth for free. Plus, a portion of each sale is donated to charities that are doing real research and helping our kids be healthier and safer. Simply click the banner below to join the movement and support our mission. Thanks in advance. Now, let's get back to episode number 2 for more life-changing information on vaccines.
My book, by Marisol, is a summary of all of the science that has been done on dimerazole, all the published peer-reviewed studies. We spent 3 years writing this. I had a team. I raised $250,000 to make sure that we looked at every scientific study that was ever done. We did not cherry-pick studies. We put everything in here. We found over 1,400 references, over 400 studies, close to 500 studies, and virtually all of them say the same thing, that dimerazole is a potent neurotoxin, also does horrendous damage to the other organs in the body. It's reactive with human tissue. It's the most toxic neurotoxic element in the universe that we know of that is not radioactive. And the science was really clear. And I was kind of naive when I wrote this book because I thought people were saying, oh, the science is clear. The science says that there's no link between thimerosal and autism. But I was reading science and couldn't verify that. Not only that, the science I was reading was saying just the opposite. And I assumed that if people saw what the science said, that the policies would then follow and attitudes would then follow. But what I encountered was in the establishment, the medical establishment, and the pharmaceutical industry and the vaccine industry was more akin to religion than science. There are six scientific studies that the CDC has relied on that are on its website. But all six of those studies have been discredited, and in fact, they're so badly discredited that when the Institute of Medicine asked to review the science of those studies, CDC instructed them not to and threatened to defund the Institute of Medicine if the Institute of Medicine tried to review those studies. Oh, it's clear that CDC knows the studies are fraudulent. The principal CDC author of there's essentially three American studies and three foreign studies, it's a Scandinavian study. The author of their Scandinavian studies, Paul Thornton, who was the CDC liaison and the data collector, is now on the run from the FBI and from Interpol for having stolen the money he was supposed to spend on that study, $1 million from CDC. He's been fired by his university, University of Aarhus in Denmark, and he is facing 22 counts of wire fraud and theft. He's wanted by Interpol and the FBI, and yet his studies are still up on CDC sites as the principal studies that supposedly exonerate dimerazole from the autism epidemic.
Next up, we have a couple of brief interviews with parents of vaccine-damaged children who believe that dimerazole was one of the culprits. I want to hear about your story, with Aiden specifically.
Yeah, he was crawling. He was very physical, crawling at 4 months, and then he started walking when he was about 10 months. And he was talking by a year. He was already saying certain things like his body parts, his hands, his head. He was identifying characters on Sesame Street like Elmo. And then a month later, we went in for his immunization shots at 13 months. He got the MMR, the pneumococcal, and the chicken pox vaccine, the varicella, on that one day. And then he stopped, the words that he was learning stopped. And then he also started having this kind of bizarre behavior, this self-stimulatory behavior and pounding on the floor and lining things up. So next time I went in to bring him into the doctor, several months later, I told her about it and that I was concerned with his speech. And he was doing kind of some babbling in the office, and she said, no, he's fine. He seems to be okay for his age. And she gave him some more shots, and then that was the end of the babbling. that he, the little language that he did have still was gone.
What, you said she gave him more shots. What shots did she give him there?
I think that time he had the DPT and the polio, as his language just disappeared completely and some of the behaviors became bizarre, like he was hitting his head and doing things that were kind of weird and dangerous. Then we took him back to the doctor and they diagnosed him with autism.
So you're in your line of work, then you're dealing with parents and children all day long that have been injured.
Parents and children and adults. As most of the cases that come in that are viable are adults, flu shot victims, Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is peripheral neuropathy, hepatitis B injuries, Gardasil injuries, which I think you've heard about, Gardasil and Cervarix. And I, in some ways, I think the reason that adults have cases that are more viable, I hear a lot of cases with children, but we can't prove any of those cases, is because with adults, first of all, they can speak. They're not infants. They can articulate the symptoms. They can be tested. The syndromes that they're experiencing are more identifiable. So it's easier for a court to fit it into their standards of proof. Then I had experience with my own son where we saw effects post-flu shot. We believe that the vaccine played a role in my son's regression. Again, the court disagrees with that. But that opened my eyes to what vaccines can do. And in fact, what I discovered, among other things, it's the policy of our country, of the United States, that vaccines cause injury. That's why you have a vaccine injury compensation program, because it's understood. It's also understood in the law, in the cases, that no one really understands how vaccines affect the human body. That's almost a direct quote from a case. So we don't know that. So what we decide is to protect the vaccine industry. We're going to compensate people, but we're only going to go so far because we don't know what really causes it, and we're going to put the burden on the injured person. And you set up this vaccine injury program, which we work in, but it's limited. I mean, and some people do get compensation. There are settlements all the time, and that's good. I'm not one of the people who say this vaccine program is horrible, it should be destroyed, but there are certain limitations to it. And the originally, that program was not designed to provide complete immunity for the vaccine industry. However, the way it's been interpreted has, in effect, provided that immunity. That prevents us from getting information and discovery. So if you sue a defendant, a vaccine manufacturer, if you have a viable claim that has some basis, you will be able to get them to answer questions. You'll be able to get them to turn over documents. You'll be able to see what their research is. We are unable to reach into the vaccine manufacturers who do the internal research, except for some rare cases where the documents have been leaked. So we are unable to develop the information that will enable us to show whether or not vaccines cause injury. But what we did learn from William Thompson is that the data that the CDC has used in several studies, there's a study called by an author named Burrell, there's the Thompson study, there's the Price study, there's the Tazi study. The data strongly suggests that thimerosal and vaccine causes harm. In those cases, ticks, and in several of the cases, speech pathology. So that's a window into this. We need to find more. We need to delve into more, but we're roadblocked by the immunity provisions. So it's been a struggle. We are working on different avenues to try to get at the truth, all in the interest of protecting children and getting simple justice for our own children.
That's our goal, protecting children. Are vaccines safe and effective? We're told that they are, but we've just seen a couple of personal stories that might lead you to question whether they are actually safe. But what about vaccines being considered effective? As far as being effective, Sherry, are they not effective at preventing disease, or what does it mean when they say that these vaccines are effective?
Well, what it means by the Webster's definition of effective, it means that you do something that achieves the intended goal. So the intended goal of when I inject a vaccine into your arm is for you to create an antibody. And so if the vaccine does that, if I inject you and it creates an antibody, it's effective. It's created its what it was intended to do. But just the mere presence of having an antibody is not the same thing as protecting you from getting sick. So vaccines are effective, if you use the scientific word, but they do not protect you from getting sick, because there are many, many substances or circumstances in the medical literature that shows that you can have high antibody levels and still contract the illness. That's even true for tetanus, that you can have very high tetanus antibodies, and unless you thoroughly clean out the wound, there's a strong possibility you may contract the infection called tetanus.
So the idea of vaccination, if we come to a modern immunological perspective, is the stimulation of the immune system to produce an antibody for a disease that they don't want you to get or manifest, right? And this is the idea, and of course they inject it primarily, there are a few exceptions to that, but they've done it in a more high-tech, so-called scientific way, so it sounds like, well, it's in a syringe, it's gotta be really scientific, it's not the same as just gathering pus from a cow udder and cutting you open and putting you in, but it's really not that much different.
The parents don't know. The doctors are bullied by the CDC. The doctors are bullied by the bottom line, by the health insurance. They're mandated, get the next shot, get the next shot. And then they bully the families into saying, look how sick he is. If you don't give him this, he's gonna get sicker. And the parents don't know. They go to neurologists. They go to, you know, neurologists are not immunologists. This is not neurology, this is immunology. This is vaccine injury, and we just haven't explored it for the entire last 2 decades. We've done nothing since we discovered an entire arm of the immune system, that of the adaptive T cell immune responses. All our vaccines generated, you know, we're not talking about a vaccine anymore. An antibody response is not a protective immune response.
I've got the transcript, it's about this thick, from, I don't know, around 2000, where they sat and they talked about these antibodies, and they go, well, we don't really want to bring up the whole discussion about antibodies because we don't really know what it means and we don't really know if they work, so let's just sort of drop that. I have that whole transcript.
Really? After our interview, Dr. Tenpenny shared with me the entire transcript. Here it is. As you can see, this document is from CBER, or the Center for Biologics Evaluation Research. Now, according to FDA.gov, CBER is the center within the FDA that regulates biological products, making sure that they are safe and effective. As you can clearly see in the document from all the orange sticky notes, the CBER clearly acknowledges multiple times that creating an antibody response, which is how we measure the effectiveness of a vaccine, has nothing to do with protecting the person from the disease. In other words, a vaccine can be deemed to be effective at creating an antibody response, but that will not necessarily protect them from the disease.
And what parents don't realize is when you go into a hospital and you sign and give permission for them to do all the routine care, you just gave permission for that vaccine. It will happen shortly after you deliver that baby. There won't be another discussion about it because you're not going to see the pediatrician until hours after birth. So you're going to finish delivering your baby, you'll get a little bit of skin time, and the nurse says, well, we're going to dry the baby off, and they take the baby away, and bam, bam, ointment. It happens like that. Like clockwork in every hospital in America, it is a standing order, at least it is in all the hospitals in Portland, Oregon, and my understanding it is that way everywhere.
The idea that the state legislators would want to force parents into taking vaccines that they don't want or that their family doesn't need really didn't sit well with me. So even as someone who is grateful for vaccines, who has vaccinated her own children because my kids have been vaccinated, I feel very strongly that parents must have a choice whether or not they want to vaccinate their kids. And there's no such thing as one-size-fits-all medicine, which means that what's right for my family, for example, the yellow fever vaccine is one that we did because we went to West Africa. What's right for my family is not necessarily right for your family. And every family should have the right to opt out. So every family should have the right to decide which vaccines are right for their children at what time. And obviously, if vaccines work and they're safe and effective, we would never worry about somebody else's child not being vaccinated. So it's completely ridiculous to say that you must do vaccines in order to protect my child, because if I want to protect my child, I can vaccinate my child. You can do what you want. That's your decision in your family based on your children's genetic vulnerabilities and your own medical history and your own exposure to disease. Medical intervention always has to be a choice.
That last statement sums up one of the main focuses of the truth about vaccines. Medical intervention must always be a choice. Now, what about polio? Was the polio vaccine effective at eradicating polio? And what exactly is polio?
Polio is not a synonym for paralysis. Most people, the vast majority of people, even at the height of where people were contracting paralysis, they would get exposed to the polio virus, which is a gastrointestinal virus that looked like the stomach flu. What people don't realize is that there are at least 7 or 8 other families of viruses that can cause paralysis. So when they show you these pictures of kids from Africa or people with a limb that's, you know, deformed, or they're dragging a limb, they're saying, see, this was polio. Well, it may have been one of the other viruses that caused paralysis.
Poliomyelitis is a description of what happens in physiologically in the body, where the anterior horn of the spinal cord is altered. And then the nerves and the muscles have downstream effects. And they can vary in intensity and duration. And it also can affect the brainstem. And those are the worst kinds of poliomyelitis. Those are the ones where the breathing centers are shut down and the iron lung was needed at the time. And people, you could die from that one. I also want to remind people that even during the worst outbreaks of polio, 95%, so if we had 100 people and we infected all of them with polio, which is a, you know, it's a virus that's swallowed, that 95% of them wouldn't even know that they had an infection. There would be no symptoms whatsoever, and there would be immunity. And then 4% would maybe have some malaise, maybe some muscle aches, some diarrhea, and then recover. And then 1% would have paralysis of one or two muscle groups that would last for 24 hours. And that 5 to 10% of those could have long-term paralysis. So the poliomyelitis was actually a very low incidence disease. Poliomyelitis being a description of a physiology doesn't actually tell you what the cause is. So that's really key to understanding what polio was and why we say it's eradicated in the United States. Even though we have cases of poliomyelitis today, we don't necessarily have poliovirus-induced cases of poliomyelitis, because the fact is that even back in the 1940s and 1950s, that any one of a number of infections could have caused poliomyelitis. And that was actually determined later, after the vaccine was released, when outbreaks would occur and the authorities wanted to distinguish what was actually poliovirus from what wasn't. And what they found was that roughly a little more than 1/4 was poliovirus, and the rest were other viruses, Coxsackie virus, etc., that can cause paralysis. And then they found no virus at all in a lot of people. So, you know, DDT and arsenic are known causes of anterior horn spinal cord disease that can mimic poliomyelitis from start to finish, even from the sore throat, the feeling of swelling in the throat, the fevers, the aches and pains, to a T.
I was under the assumption that polio was synonymous with paralysis, but apparently I was mistaken, as 95% of people with polio have no symptoms whatsoever, and less than 1% of the people with polio actually suffer paralysis. Dr. Humphreys just mentioned that DDT and arsenic are both known causes of anterior horn spinal disease, which looks just like paralytic polio. Let's learn more about this intriguing subject from Dr. Rashid Buttar.
What's really interesting is when you start looking at the incidence of usage of certain chemicals. For example, I wasn't alive at that time and neither were you, but back in the 40s, they used to say, in 50s, they used to say, I've had my DDT, so I'm insect-free, or something like that.
I've seen a cartoon, and there was a newspaper at that time that said DDT is good for me.
That's right. DDT is good for me, right.
Yeah.
And flies won't bother me because I've had my DDT, okay? There were little slogans like that.
Yeah.
Remember, like in the 50s and 60s, again, not remember because you and I weren't alive then. We were in the 60s, but not in the 50s. But they used to say cigarettes. A cigarette a day will keep the doctor away.
Yeah, a pack a day keeps lung cancer away. I've seen that one too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So these are strange things that they believed back then, right? Now we're talking about vaccines are important, and they've stamped out all these diseases. Well, look at polio. So polio is supposed to have been stamped out because of vaccines. That's BS. You look at on a graph on the use of DDT, and you look at the incidence of polio, and they are exactly the same graph, except that polio followed DDT by about 6 months. So as DDT peaked, 6 months later polio peaked. A DDT comes down, 6 months later polio comes down. DDT flatlines, polio flatlines. It follows the contour. It's like taking the same graph and just displacing it by 6 months.
Invented in the late 19th century as a nerve gas chemical weapon, in 1938, DDT was repackaged for use as a mosquito killer. It was applied liberally from 1943 through 1952 on swimming pools and school cafeterias full of children. I checked out the graphs, and Dr. Buttar was 100% accurate. The rise and fall of polio does actually correspond with the usage of DDT. Notice that in 1948, the DDT usage was at its lowest, and then in 1951, it was at its highest. Now, look at this graph of polio cases beginning in 1950. As you can clearly see, they peaked in 1951-1952 with approximately 58,000 cases. Then they began to decline drastically. In 1955, the year that polio vaccine was introduced, there were 28,985 cases of polio. Is it possible that many cases of polio were actually DDT poisoning? Is it possible that the decrease in DDT was a contributing factor in the reduction of polio cases? Or are there other factors as well?
Back in the late 1950s and 1960s, they actually legally changed the definition of polio when they came out with the polio vaccine. They made it much more difficult to diagnose cases of polio when they came out with the polio vaccine. So that was partially responsible for the making the vaccine look more effective than it was at the time.
They did a couple of things. So in the beginning, it was highly inflated. So for instance, in order to get subsidized, these cases that were in the hospitals and being treated, anyone could make the diagnosis of polio before the vaccine. So all it took was somebody to do an exam, two exams, 24 hours apart, and finding one or more muscle groups that had paralysis. And so that would be called polio. There was no, blood or stool testing or anything like that. And then after the vaccine was released, not just anybody could confirm a case of polio. And there had to be two examinations done 60 days apart that showed one or more muscle groups that remained paralyzed for 60 days. Now, mind you, the majority of paralytic polio, even back in 1954, would resolve within 60 days. So just by changing that diagnostic criteria, they eliminated a huge amount of polio. There were cases that were called aseptic meningitis. So this was polio, but not necessarily paralysis. Those were all taken off the books as being called polio. They increased the number of cases that needed to occur in order to be called an epidemic. So these were some of the moves that were made at the time, and then they started testing for the actual virus. So that eliminated. So whether or not a vaccine ever came out, polio would have decreased probably down by 3/4, whether just because of the change in the criteria.
The first polio vaccine was the inactivated, in other words, the killed polio vaccine. It was developed by Jonas Salk, and it came into use in 1955. Albert Sabin's live polio vaccine was introduced in 1960. The standards for defining polio were changed in 1955 when the Salk polio vaccine was introduced. The new definition of polio epidemic required more cases to be reported. Paralytic polio was redefined as well, making it more difficult to confirm and therefore to tally. Also, after the vaccine was introduced, cases of aseptic meningitis, which is an infectious disease often difficult to distinguish from polio, were supposed to be reported as a different disease than polio. But before the polio vaccine, these cases were counted as polio. Here's a chart that's based on the Los Angeles County Health Index on morbidity and mortality of reportable diseases. As you can see, in Los Angeles County, July 1955, right before the polio vaccine was introduced, there were 273 cases of polio and 50 cases of aseptic meningitis. But then 6 years later, in 1961, there were only 65 cases of polio and 161 cases of aseptic meningitis. These numbers were 5 and 256, respectively, by the year 1966. Is it possible that it only appeared that polio was eradicated because they changed the criteria for diagnosing polio and thus giving rise to the spike in cases of aseptic meningitis?
The fact of the matter is that The first vaccines that were released had live virus in them and were actually causing more paralysis than they were preventing. And that's, again, very well demonstrated in graphics from the, I believe it was 1954 to 1958. There's a graph in the book that shows you the amounts of poliomyelitis or paralysis that was occurring, and was occurring largely in vaccinated populations. And the only reason that vaccine didn't cause more problems than it did was because the majority of the population was already immune to polio. So they could be injected with a live vaccine and not have an effect from it. But it would have been a disaster had it been what we call a virgin population who had never been exposed to it. It would have been an absolute medical disaster. I mean, the Qatar incident was a medical disaster where there was a very highly packed vaccine with live virus given to the public, and so Qatar basically took the rap for that problem and had to close their doors. But the truth was that Wyeth was also releasing similar vaccine.
The Qatar incident is an example of the polio vaccine actually causing polio because of an insufficiently killed virus in the salt polio vaccine from Qatar Laboratories in Berkeley, California. Over 40,000 children were infected, many were paralyzed, and many died. In 1977, Dr. Jonas Salk testified, along with other scientists, that mass inoculation against polio was the cause of most polio cases throughout the USA since 1961. Are there cases of the polio vaccine causing other diseases, like cancer?
What do you know, Barbara, about the Salk and Sabin versions of the polio vaccine?
Well, we know that the original Salk inactivated vaccines, polio vaccines that were given to over 100 million children, including me, I got several Salk polio shots, were contaminated with simian virus 40 because those vaccines used rhesus monkey kidney tissue cells to produce the vaccines. In 1960, an NIH scientist, Bernice Eddy, found that rhesus monkey kidney cells that were used to produce the inactivated Salk vaccine caused cancer when they were injected into hamsters.
Even today, I, for one, likely have SV40 in my body because my mom received the vaccine, so it gets passed down transgenerationally, even though I didn't receive that vaccine. So it stays in our body, it's passed down into future generations, potentially forever, and that is one of the sort of Pandora's box events that occurred in the history of vaccination.
Fast forward to the 1990s. Researchers began to culture out SV40 DNA from the tumors, the cancerous tumors, of children and adults suffering with bone, brain, and lung cancer. SV40 DNA. They made an association between the contaminated polio vaccines and the SV40 DNA that they're culturing out. Independent labs across the world confirmed SV40 DNA in these cancers. Not only adults that got the vaccines, but children. The government, the federal government, said no association. There's no association between SV40 DNA and these tumors and the cancers. It continues to be an outstanding question about whether the people like me and others who got contaminated vaccines, contaminated with a simian virus, a monkey virus, potentially pass down to their children the SV40 DNA that then caused brain, bone, and lung cancers in these children, as well as in the adults who got them. This is still an outstanding question. Nobody wants to talk about it. You won't find anybody talking about it because the scientists in the 90s who tried to look into this and say something about it were vilified. And these were scientists from very prestigious universities. Whenever doctors and scientists try to do the right thing when it comes to vaccine risk issues, they are punished. They're punished by the government. They lose government grants. They are vilified in the media. It's the same with the physician who steps forward and tries to be honest and recognize and have a conscience and say, we need to do something different. We need to do something. Care about these children. Demonized, vilified. as if, you know, try to drum these people out of society because they were honest. This is not the way that science should be conducted. It's not the way that we should be rewarding people who are trying to do the right thing.
In 2002, the British journal Lancet published compelling evidence to support the polio vaccine linked to cancer. In the article, the authors assert that the polio vaccine contaminated with SV40 was responsible for up to half of the 55,000 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma cases that were occurring each year. Dr. Maurice Hilleman was the developer of Merck's vaccine program. He developed over 36 vaccines, more than any other scientist in history. He was a member of the United States National Academy of Science, the Institute of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. He received a special Lifetime Achievement Award from the World Health Organization. Hilleman was one of the early vaccine pioneers to warn about the possibility that simian viruses might contaminate vaccines. In total, over 60 different lab studies have linked the Salk polio vaccine to cancer, which Hilleman admits was the responsibility of Merck. I learned recently that the oral polio vaccine actually sheds polio. Now, what exactly does that mean? Let's listen to Dr. Sean Sinners explain.
Take something like the polio virus. The oral polio has had a number of issues. When I was a resident back in the late 1990s, we still gave an oral polio vaccine, which is you took a little liquid, you swallowed it. But because that was a live virus, every year there were hundreds of children who were actually getting polio.
From the oral vaccine?
From the oral vaccine. And so around 99, 2000, they made the decision because of this to stop giving the oral polio. And they now have an inactivated form, which obviously is safer. But then there's also a question of even whether this vaccine is effective. There are three types of wild polio, 1, 2, and 3. And type 1 and 3 was highly protective with the oral polio vaccine. But type 2, with the inactivated polio, which is what we use now, it's not very effective. So you have hundreds of thousands and millions of parents who think that their child is protected from polio because they have this inactivated polio vaccine, but in fact that may not be the case.
So the oral polio shot, which we don't give in this country since 2000 because every case of polio since the 60s was from the vaccine, the oral polio vaccine is a live vaccine and it was shedding, people shed and get polio from it, right, and give it to other people. So we halted the use of it, but it's what they use in third world countries because it's cheap. And
we're having these polio outbreaks.
We're having polio outbreaks, and people are like, oh, we need to vaccinate with more OPV. You know, and like the Gates Foundation came to the Uttar Pradesh in India in 2010 or 2011, and because there was like, on average, I don't know, 9 or 10 cases of wild polio every year out of, you know, millions of people. Yeah. And had this polio campaign with the OPV. And within 2 years, there were 47,500 cases of flaccid paralysis, or polio. They're not calling it polio.
They changed the name, right?
They changed, but they're calling it, but it's basically what you would call polio.
Right.
These kids are paralyzed, or they died from paralysis. And Bill Gates, at least it said it was Bill Gates in the Huffington Post, wrote an article how, oh my God, we've eradicated wild polio in India, in the Uttar Pradesh. But wild, you know, he said wild. He couldn't say polio because the vaccine strain is
right.
Causing outbreaks. You can't use live viruses in a vaccine in areas where there is no sewage and no clean water.
Allopathic medicine takes a contrarian approach to viruses. And look at the results of that. They want to attack every virus or bacteria with a chemical. So what has that led to? Decades later, you know, a century into allopathic medicine, what do we have? Drug-resistant superbugs that now threaten humanity. We've reached the era of the end of antibiotics. And that's a statement from the World Health Organization. That's not just Mike Adams saying that, right? We have reached a time when you could die from a superbug infection from getting a scratch and going to the hospital, where you're likely to be infected by other patients and doctors and health practitioners who do not follow sanitary practices, who are actually spreading disease. The system of modern medicine is doing more of the spreading of disease than the prevention of disease. Now, a holistic approach to this would say, let's strengthen the vitality of the patient. Let's change their terrain. Let's give them the biochemistry tools in their own bodies to respond and adapt and overcome infections. And once you do that, they're immune to so many things that could come out there, whether that virus mutates or not. Remember, even the CDC admits that oftentimes the flu shot is completely ineffective because they chose the wrong strain of the virus. But if you have natural immunity in your body, in your system, then that is more of a broad spectrum immunity against more mutant variations of that virus. So where if you go the vaccine route, you have to be lucky and make sure that they hit you with just that right strain, which is usually last year's circulating virus, which is why I say vaccines are great for time travelers. If you want to go back to last year, and maybe a vaccine could help you, but for this year, virus is already mutated. So you need an adaptive response from your body that can adapt to all those mutations in real time, usually in a symptomless way where you don't even know that you were exposed or that you adapted. Also, one more thing, Ty. Remember that you cannot turn off your immune response either. It's automatic. It's built into your system. It's part of who you are. It's part of your biology, your chemistry, even your spirit, your consciousness, I believe. It's part of you. You can't turn it off. If a virus comes in and it starts attacking your body responds to it as long as it has the tools in the immunology.
The truth is, there is actually, and this is another thing that's very hard for people to understand, but there are benefits to getting certain illnesses. We know that. You know, we know that exposure to certain diseases will reduce our risk of later of problems later in life. We actually know that certain infectious diseases help us not get autoimmune disorders. That's something that's very hard for Americans to understand because we've been fed so much propaganda and so much fear-mongering. A parent who chooses not to vaccinate is making a decision. They're making an evidence-based decision that they would rather take the risk of being exposed to infectious disease than they would in taking the risk of being exposed to vaccines. That is an absolutely reasonable, smart, and evidence-based choice. It might not be the choice that I make. I might decide that I'm afraid of my child being exposed to polio and getting polio. And you might decide that you're not afraid of your child getting polio. But those are appropriate decisions, and that's an appropriate conversation to have. There's no anti or pro here. There's no good or bad here. There's taking the information you have and making the best decision you can with it.
There is no anti or pro. It's just making good decisions, using the knowledge that we have, and exercising our freedom of choice. All parents love their children, and all parents want to make the best health decisions for their children. We should all do our due diligence and become educated on vaccines. Here's Erin Elizabeth, who sustained a vaccine injury as a child, with some encouraging words.
Growing up in the 70s, we actually had some of the hippies who didn't vaccinate back then. It was kind of that mentality where some didn't. And the few friends I had who weren't vaccinated were the healthiest of all. They didn't have colds. They weren't sick. They were eating their organic granola and healthy as can be. But I don't want my parents to feel guilty. They are still pro-vaccine, although I think they're opening their eyes to these things. I think that but I never want them to feel any kind of guilt or anything, but it's just they were doing what the pediatrician told them.
So many people will do due diligence and research when they go to buy a car, when they go to buy a house, but when someone's going to inject something into you or your child, you don't do that same due diligence, and yet the vaccine you get could harm you. Unpredictably, you can be healthy and still get harmed. Or you can be somebody who's genetically or biologically more susceptible than other people, and your risks are much greater. So the message is, buyer beware. Patient beware. Become educated about infectious diseases and vaccines, and make the very best decision that you can for yourself or your child before you get vaccinated.
Hope- Hopefully this episode has given you a lot of information that's valuable when you're making health decisions for you and for your family. Thanks again for watching, and please tune in again for the next episode.